You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, community-powered, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. And we're in our last month on the air. So Writers' Voices will soon be moving. Stay tuned, and we'll give you information about later about where you'll be able to hear Writers' Voices. And, of course, one place is always writersvoices.com. So this is Writers' Voices, and I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and it is snowing like cats and dogs out there today in this snowy February day. So my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn, is not able to be with us today, but I have a wonderful co-host who was on one of my very first shows over 10 years ago talking about writing when we first started out. I think you were maybe my second guest or something like that.
I think I was on with Paul, yes.
Yeah. So Crystal Guerin, welcome to Writers' Voices. And you want to tell our listeners who we have today?
We have Emily Miles Terry, Times best-selling author of Nesting, It's a Chick Thing, and Postcards from the Bump. She is the co-founder of Open Book Publicity, a national literary publicity company which has publicized hundreds of best-selling books in a wide range of genres, from parenting to health and cooking to science fiction. Currently, Emily lives in the Boston area, and when she isn't talking about books, she's trying to write another one.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Emily.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I've booked a lot of authors on your show and heard many good things.
Well, yes, you have, and we very much appreciate that. And yeah, I feel like that you must hear good things because you keep bringing more authors to me.
Yeah, I think, what authors are looking for and publishers too, or a forum where they can have a good amount of time to talk about their book. I think it's really hard to sum up a book and get to the important points in a 3-minute interview. So it's rare to find a longer format interview, where you can really go into depth on things. And there are very few hosts that can choose to interview novelists. So that's, a tricky thing, as I'm sure. So you're a rare bird.
Well, I like to read novels, so that's why I like to interview our novelists, because then I get an excuse to read all these great new books.
Right.
Yeah. But,
me too. Isn't that why we're all in writing and publishing?
Oh, yes.
So, Emily, how did you make the jump from writing to publicity, or were you in publicity first and then published your own books, or what? Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, my career started in New York at Doubleday right out of college, and I was in the publicity department. So I loved it from the minute I walked in. I just knew that being in the world of books and ideas and authors and was really where I was meant to be, and I was fortunate enough to meet some terrific mentors, and I stuck with it and ended up on the West Coast at a small press. And at one point in time, they approached myself and a good friend of mine who worked there, who was in art production, Amy Beanland, and said, this topic of women and sisterhood and friendships is really hot. We need a book. Can you guys come up with something? Because you seem to be good friends. So we did. We wrote together It's a Chick Thing, which is an anthology. And, it's just been really amazing to be on both ends of, this publishing journey. And there are a lot of people out there that do that, that are editors who also write, or, marketing specialists who also write. Because I think, ultimately we're all, like you, attracted to the written word. Mm. And it's really fun to engage in it and do different things. I think as being an author and knowing how that feels and what it's like to be through the publicity process has really enhanced my abilities as a book publicist. I understand what they're going through. I understand their fears. I understand, when it's hard. And I also know, I think, you know, how to prep them a little bit for the journey, because it's difficult. You know, you're sort of, as a writer, kind of, you know, very insulated from the outer world. A lot of times that's what you have to do to get through a novel or a big book, or if you're a researcher or a scientist, you're really kind of in your lab or in your writing space, and then you come out and you have to talk about your book constantly. So it can be a really difficult transition. A lot of authors are introverts at heart, and so just trying to get people to feel comfortable with that. And, you know, part of our job too is to really go out there and find outlets for writers to talk where people who, you know, love them, love the written word. You know, it wasn't going to be a gotcha interview where they're trying to trick anyone. It's not political. You know, it's not about getting in an argument. And, you know, we found different shows, radio shows that are really positive all around the country, mostly in local markets, that, you know, will give the author a great conversation and give them a chance to reach people mm-hmm. who care about the written word.
Well, we're certainly glad that you do. You do that. So, Emily, when at what point did you decide to go out and launch your own publicity firm, Open Book Publicity, with your partner Leslie Rosman?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, we, you know, for years did work in the house, and that meaning that we worked, you know, at various publishers. And there was just a point in the time when my family was, we were moving, my husband was going to graduate school, and we needed to move out of the Bay Area. So we struck out sort of on my own. Now, I had hired Leslie, my business partner now, as a freelancer before, so I knew she was the best person in the world, with the hardest worker, the really experienced, very driven and committed. So when we started sort of loosely working together, and that worked out great, and then we formalized it about 1998. So it's been a long time.
Wow. Well, I'm curious about, I mean, you work mostly with authors from major publishing companies and some independent publishing companies. How does that, you know, do those companies still have their own publicity departments? And how is the decision made to engage your firm rather than the in-house publicist?
Right. That's a good question. I think, you know, we have really specialized in an area that publishers aren't really able to replicate what we do, because they have so many things they have to cover. An in-house person has, you know, maybe 10 books a month that they need to promote, and they're also looking at, you know, other forms of broadcast like television interviews and print, which is very important too. So you know, it's a little bit of a mystery as to exactly how or why different publishers decide to hire out. But, you know, sometimes it's just overload on their in-house departments. Sometimes it's a book that they think has a really good chance and needs an extra push on radio. Sometimes they hire us when all their efforts are done and things have gone really well, but they need to move on. Their staff needs to move on to other projects and, you know, forthcoming books. But they want to keep the momentum going, so mm-hmm. they'll hire us on the back end. But a lot of times I think it's really they're hiring us because of our specialty in this area that's unique, and, you know, sort of something that they're not able to do themselves. But I think there are a lot of really good publicists in various publishers that that work very hard and get a lot of things done. So it's not to say that we're, you know, the only game in town.
So you're talking about your specialty. Are you talking about women's literature, or what would you say your specialty is?
When I say that, I mean radio.
I
see. You know, in terms of book publicity.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because you do bring a lot of different, you do bring us a lot of novels, but there's a lot of nonfiction as well. I have seen quite a few historical novels, I think, coming through, which is one of my favorite genres to read. So I always love that. tell us a little bit, Emily, about when you get a new client, how do you start the process of working with that client?
Well, first we assess the book and the author's credentials. We're looking for a few things. One, you know, a book that we know that people like you who read a lot, who have discerning taste and who want to have a good conversation, you know, that it will work in that format. Once we've determined that, we look at our own schedule and make sure that we aren't already working on a book that's too similar. And that's important, too, because we want to offer a variety of different types of topics and authors and genres when we're talking to radio stations. So we look for that, any redundancies, and make sure that we're not going to kind of cannibalize our own efforts, if you will. And then, you know, we sort of look at the logistics. I mean, it's remarkable how many times people hire us or try to hire us and they're really not available. It's a time-consuming, you know, it's a time-intensive commitment. And, you know, we can do things internationally. We can do a lot, but we do need, you know, a fair amount of hours from the author. And sometimes that's just not possible. Mm. So, but those are, you know, the kind of things that we look at to, you know, assess things. You know, we make sure that philosophically we believe, you know, on a, you know, kind of a more, you know, in the tenets of the book, if you will. Like, we're not going to work on a book that doesn't jive with a strong belief of ours.
So no Holocaust deniers need apply.
Yeah, we've had some interesting calls over the years too. We had this was so funny. It was like a guy who was a big mobster's associate, and he had a book. And he kind of called us like, "Hello," you know, in deep voice, like, "Oh, we're busy. We can't take anyone on right now." You just never know, you know, what's going to happen when the phone rings and someone reaches out to us. But yeah, it's. Generally, we have a lot of really good options. It's just more, you know, really figuring out who can fit in and making sure the timing works and that kind of thing. But we like to represent cookbooks as well as novels, as well as we do a fair amount of children's books, and that's really important to us sort of philosophically. We both have kids, and we really have tried to raise them to be readers, too, so... We like to do kids' books.
Did you just send me the Boards and Platters book? Was that one yours?
You know, Chronicle Books. Yeah. We're that they used our list for that.
Okay.
Like, isn't
okay.
that yummy?
Yeah.
I know. I thought they just had such good ideas.
Oh, I know. It's like makes me want to entertain.
Yeah, definitely. And it was so unique. I just would never think of anything like that. I'm not a good cook myself, so.
Well, I was just in Italy. I was in Italy twice last year for my nephew's ordination as a deacon in the Roman Catholic Church in September at St. Peter's Basilica. And then I went back and took my sister, his mother, back in December because he was serving as... the deacon on the altar with Pope Francis for his New Year's Day Mass. So we went for that. And one of the restaurants that the three of us went to, my sister and I and my nephew in Rome, it was like number one in Yelp. And they did these huge meat and cheese and condiment platters on boards. And the board, like for three of us, was about 3 feet long. And about maybe 8 inches wide. And I thought, we're never going to be able to eat all that. But somehow we did. Of course, my nephew's 6'6", I think, so that helps. But but it was amazing. And, you know, I don't think we really, there probably are restaurants here that do that sort of thing. But man, that was impressive.
Yeah, that's great. We probably did borrow the idea from them.
Yep.
Don't do it quite as well, right?
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. My co-host today is Crystal Guerin, and our guest is Emily Miles Terry, who is the co-founder of Open Book Publicity. And I noticed on your website that you say you do not represent self-published authors. And let's talk about that a little bit, why you came to that decision, and did you ever try to do that, to represent self-published authors?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was kind of what, you know, I touched on before, is that we personally need to vet the books to make sure what we're representing is, of a certain quality, and but I think we're not publishers, so we didn't feel comfortable or feel like we were able to truly dig through a book and read it from cover to cover just as a prospective title, and we did need a book publisher to help us with that. That said, we do take on self-published books.
Discourage them.
If it's someone that's a referral from someone else we know or highly respected so-and-so, I guess that's sort of a lesson in book publishing in general, is that, people got their book published because they were aggressive and didn't take no for an answer. And so some people, if they look at the books we've represented and they're really believing in their book, and they'll still come after us, and sometimes, it definitely works out. So it's hard to keep a website updated, and the industry has been very dynamic. So I think, we do represent self-published books. Yeah, from pretty, I'd say probably one or two a year at least, maybe more.
Is that a factor in how dynamic a book is received? I mean, how well it does, how dynamic the author is and how aggressive they are?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of authors are just kind of almost like activists in a way. You know, they're really dogged, and it seems like you have to be, one, to get an agent, and then to get published, and then to, figure out how to market yourself. So I do think that seems to be a trait that's, you're almost like a little bit like your own entrepreneur in a way, representing yourself, and, people can be, I find that they can be quite talented and quite dogged and good at running their businesses, for sure.
Well, if you're self-publishing, that's even more true that you have to be, it's a business, really. You can't just have the writing talent. You have to do the whole thing.
Yes, that is tricky. And, we have had some friends that have done it and then decided not to do it again because it was so hard.
Yeah.
I think, it makes a lot of sense for some people that are business authors, I think, that are really doing it as more as an extension of their professional work,
mm-hmm.
as almost like another business card, but a better one for people, rather than a typical author who's maybe doing it as a full-time writer, so to speak.
Yeah, we've interviewed a lot of authors, of course, over the years, because we've been on the air over 11 years, and we've had self-published authors. Some start out with self-publishing because they don't want to take the time. Like if the book has a time factor, it needs to get out there more quickly. You can get to the market more quickly. Or
absolutely true.
Or they just didn't think they'd be able to, or had not been successful at attracting a publisher. So they start out with self-publishing, and then if they get some traction with that first book, they are more able to attract a publisher the next time around.
Right.
Sometimes it goes the other way, where someone published with a publisher initially, and maybe they're, I've had a couple that were like wanting to write in a different genre that their publisher wouldn't take, and so they self-published those, but because they had a name already, it made it a little easier. There seems to be a fluidity of going back and forth between, for some writers, between using a publishing house and self-publishing. And,
right.
You know, most of, a lot of them don't just do one way. It just depends on the situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you might liken it to an actor who's, you know, sometimes acting in a theater and sometimes putting themselves in a major motion picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
People want to get their craft out there, their work out there, and there are a lot of different ways to do that now, which is great.
Emily, in what ways has the publishing industry changed in the time that you've been working in it? And, you know, what would you say is the most impactful change?
Probably Amazon. I think when I first started, we didn't even have email, which is funny. I mean, and I remember when we first got voicemail. So
I remember when we first got fax.
Right. Sorry.
I remember when we first got fax.
Oh, gosh, I hated the fax. Reams of paper. Oh, boy. I just remember standing there waiting for something to come, and it was never mine. Always somebody else. So I think, you know, there was a time, you know, when I was in the 90s when the technology boom was just happening, and the publishers really didn't jump on the web thing at all. They didn't understand it. Of course, I mean, nobody really understood it and what it would mean. And, you know, then suddenly we were in the position of every author contract, there would be a real catfight over the electronic rights. And that was sort of a big trend for a while. And then, I mean, I do think, you know, Amazon's business practices have, I really do have mixed, if not, you know, bad feelings about, in terms of what they mean in the end to the quality and output of books. But, you know, we can't fight progress, right? So just have to kind of roll and hopefully adjust. You know, I do think it's the rise of technology in general. We're just competing for people's times. When you're in the business of content, you know, there's so much for people to be doing. And, you know, whether they're playing a video game or an app or, you know, whatever, watching a movie on their phone, we just didn't have that in the beginning. So it's become harder and harder to sell a book. And then I think then we had sort of the presidential election, and the news cycle just sped up like crazy. You know, it's just like even more, it sort of cannibalized everybody's time, sort of immersed us all in this like crazy kind of argument amongst each other. And then, you know, hopefully we're coming out of it where people have a little more downtime. But there were, in publicity, it changed a lot. I mean, the all-powerful Oprah and the Today Show no longer exist in the same way. We still have some radio shows that can be quite impactful in terms of sales and really get a book out there. But it's just interesting to see how books, you know, get sold and what sparks it. And that maybe is a little more democratic, I guess. But because it could be almost anything these days, but it's definitely harder to sell a book, I'd say. Mm.
Do you think that people are reading as much as they did 30 years ago, reading books as much as they did 30 years ago?
I don't have the data on that exactly, but I just from my own personal observations, I'd say no. I mean, I just see the competition, too, for the kids and the Instagram and all the social media and just how that eats away at their time. So I can't imagine they're reading as much as they used to. What do you think?
I don't know, because there's still a lot of young adult books that sell a lot.
Yes. And the millennials are readers.
Yes.
As a generation, they're known to be readers, so which is great.
Yeah. You know, I have grandkids that are elementary age, and they love to read. They love their screens, too, but they read a lot.
Business has been, you know, has had some really robust years, and they also, the kids do like traditional books in a lot of cases. That's what's kind of interesting as well. Although, the big readers, I think, do use the Kindles. But.
Right. Well, my grandson likes, I think he prefers traditional books. He's 8, but he reads books about Minecraft.
My son does that too.
No, my granddaughters, they like the picture books. They want pictures, and they like to feel them. So they don't really, they have the electronic books, but they like the feeling.
Yeah. Well, it does seem like there's opportunities for writers in, maybe more opportunities for writers because the digital world needs content too. But it's just a little different, you know, creating a video game, you know, the storyline for a video game or something like that.
It is interesting when those things go into the different formats and narratives throughout. I think it's we haven't publicized that many of those books, but we have publicized a lot of picture books and middle grade books and YA. And, you know, I think that was one thing that, Harry Potter did, was sort of change the way that those books were sold. For one, she went from middle grade genre all the way up to YA. So she kind of, you know, brought these two genres together in terms of ages. And then also she really pulled in adults.
Absolutely.
I have this memory of seeing.
And then, subsequent to that, John Green did, and a lot of other YA authors, Philip Pullman, and, people started to enjoy, or adults started to enjoy, and there was sort of, no shame in that.
That's for sure.
I was just saying, I remember seeing a little boy. I went out to lunch one time at a restaurant, and I saw a little boy clutching his Harry Potter book. It was his, and he was supposed to be eating, and his mother was like, no, you have to eat now. And he wanted to read his book. And it was so impressive to me, that it meant that much to them, like their own private world. And I think that's what books are for people.
Yeah. I call that with kids, it's kind of the book bite. I think that if you can get them, as I have a lot of friends that ask me, how do you get your kids to be a reader? And I think if you can get them to have that first sort of love affair with a book, then they're going to always be looking for it again. And but I do think it's interesting the different ways that kids read. I mean, my daughter was just like sort of born a reader. She would read a book a day, I think, when she was in fourth or fifth grade. My second was a rereader, which I objected to at first, but then I learned to appreciate it. And he's actually a fantastic writer, I think, as a result. But he would just reread the Harry Potter series.
Oh.
And again.
Interesting.
He'd be like, don't you want to try something new? Nope.
Those are the ones that turn into writers,
of
it
that.
Seems.
Yeah. And then my youngest is much more into graphic books. Like the Minecraft ones you were talking about. And that, is, I think, has changed, too. There are a lot more of them, a lot higher quality than there used to be. And, they're pretty, pretty amazing. So he kind of goes back and forth between sort of typical, regular kind of prose and prose fiction and then the illustrated books, which I also kind of fought a little bit at first, I will admit, but then I gave in, and then I began to see the merit in reading those, because they're really, really amazing books, too.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Emily Miles Terry, the co-founder of Open Book Publicity, and my co-host is Crystal Guerin.
So has it changed having your children, what your children read? Has that changed what you are interested in publicizing?
Definitely. I think my business partner and I had the same kind of experience because our kids are about the same age, or at least our older children are. And we just personally started to really appreciate and love all sorts of children's books and know them really well and see how excited and how formative and influential they were on our kids. And so that became sort of an important cause. And we worked hard to kind of find radio interviews who could interview people about kids' books, because typically all these shows are meant for adults, right? Radio shows are mostly meant for adults. So
right.
That was also an interesting thing to kind of ferret out different people around the country who wanted to talk on the radio to authors who were writing children's books. And so we've worked with some really famous children's authors, and, you know, some of them have been historical in nature and historical fiction. We're, you know, going to take on a few more very soon in March. It's, you know, it's always fun. And they're a good bunch, the children's book authors.
Well, we've interviewed...
they're tough. They're used to kind of going into a gymnasium full of 400 kids, and the teacher's like, see you later, we'll come back in a couple hours. Keep them entertained for us, would you? You know, they're good sports, I find.
We've interviewed a lot of young adult authors, and like you said, that's ideal because a lot of those books appeal to kids and adults. Mm-hmm. I have done picture book, you know, and middle, you know, lower, like chapter book authors. It's a little hard to do in a whole hour on that sometimes.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like if they read the book, they can read the whole book out loud in 5 minutes. And
so. Oh, but describing
right.
pictures,
yeah.
You know?
I mean, I think, for instance, we have a book right now that we're working on called I Am Harriet Tubman.
Oh, I just got that yesterday.
Yep.
Yeah.
Get it? Yeah. So, right. So that is a little book, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're hoping the bigger conversation about Black History Month and Harriet Tubman in particular will kind of carry that along. And the author's done a lot of research. That said, not a lot of people have an hour like you do.
Well, sometimes we'll do a half hour, you know, 2 half-hour segments,
right,
for that sort
yeah,
of thing.
You're very brave.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a lot more in-depth, I think, than a lot of people do. But the authors love it, and they appreciate it a lot.
So, Emily, looking at your, again, at your website and some of the authors that you've represented in the past that really jumped out at me, Tom Robbins, is he as interesting in real life as he is on the page?
Yes. You know, has a lot of personality. I think, that's been many years since we worked with him. But we, you know, what's funny, too, is these different personalities. And I think... when for instance, we were just recently worked with a sleep expert, a neuroscientist who specializes in sleep. Well, very consistently, he needs his 8 hours. He will not get up early for a radio interview. You know, so it's interesting how the interplay of what they're writing about comes, you know, in terms of our working process and our working together. I think... you know, what we really love are authors who give fantastic interviews. I mean, that's always the goal, right?
Right.
And we coach people on different techniques, but some people are just gifted in that way, and they've had a lot of experience, and they know what they're doing. And those authors, to me, are real standouts, like Andrew Solomon, who wrote Far From the Tree, nonfiction. He's just, you know, gripping, fantastic. The sleep doctor I just mentioned, Matt Walker, who is talking about pretty difficult neuroscience, and he's able to distill it into very simple, eloquent nuggets. It doesn't hurt that he has a British accent. He sounds smart no matter what he's saying, but he says a lot of extremely bright things. And then I think, you know, Laurie Halse Anderson was one of our favorites to work with.
Yeah.
She is incredibly eloquent and, you know, National Book Award winner and just also a very organized person, extremely professional. You know, we worked with John Green at one point. He's extremely funny. Let's see. Oh, we're working on a book soon, too, and it's a very, very serious book, and it's a middle grade book, and I love the juxtaposition. It's about a girl that goes undercover in Nazi Germany, basically.
Oh, wow.
And it's a very intense, pretty dark book, I think. Mm. And but then the bio, the author wrote is just hysterical, you know. And so I love that kind of idea that he would write a really serious book, but he's actually quite funny, funny guy. The book is called Orphan Monster Spy, and it's coming out at the end of March. And it takes place in World War II in Germany. But the author's name is Matt Colleen. And, you know, he says funny things like, you know, one day I accidentally moved to the countryside. You know, I don't know how that happened. You know, just, that's just very funny. British sense of humor. But that's, you know, always great. We don't necessarily always love working with celebrities, and we have before. But sometimes it's just like becomes the logistics and the time limitations make it not as fun for us.
Mm.
They just don't have as much time to give to the campaigns, and for us it's important, and, you know, to try to get the word out about their books to as many people as possible, so we do get frustrated if we're limited in that way. Mm. Most recently we worked on Norwich by Karen Krauss, and I don't think you interviewed her. I think the timing just wasn't great,
right,
but you probably
right.
have the book in your pile.
Yes, I do.
Now, but she is a New York Times reporter, sports reporter. I admire her a great deal. And she, her book is about this tiny town in Vermont. It's nonfiction, and that have raised, and a lot of Olympians have come out of the town more than any other town in America. But the interesting part is that their culture is not what you would think. It's not this sort of, okay, you know, you're going to ski every day, since, you know, but it's for, you know, between when you learn to walk and, you know, when you go off to the Olympics. It's not like that. They have a very sort of nurturing, creative, supportive network. They let the kids do all sorts of different sports and try out all sorts of different things, and they believe in the town of, which I think is really great, no cuts on teams. And, you know, as Karen explains, when you have no cuts on a sports team, what that means is these very accomplished sort of prodigy athletes have friends that aren't necessarily those types of athletes, but give them, so in that, they give them balance.
Mm.
And their whole world isn't just skiing or snowboarding or, you know, some kind of Olympic competition. They also have friends who, you know, like to knit or draw or, you know, do different things. So it's just a really positive.
Well, that probably also gives kids who may be late bloomers a chance to compete on something that in another place they would have been cut and dropped out and gotten discouraged and never gone back to.
True, definitely. That's really true. But what I like. You know, every month it's sort of a different set of authors.
About how many authors do you work with at a time, Emily?
It varies, but, you know, usually we're at various stages of five and six, I'd say, a month, kind of going through a few months, and, you know, some are finishing up, and some are, you know, coming on new. So we can't handle much more than that.
How long does a typical campaign last?
Usually it lasts for 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, it depends. If we have a really heavy news time, you know, like right after an election, or maybe even through snowstorms, bad winter seasons, that kind of vacation times. It can stretch on a little longer for various reasons, but that's generally about, and that's about all people, authors, can kind of handle. At first, they're so eager. They're like, yay, and then by the end, they're like, please leave me alone. I had enough radio interviews with you. I want my life back. But even though they enjoy it, it is a fair amount of work and a big time commitment for them.
I
and
bet.
A lot of them want to get back to writing, too.
Emily, what was it like working with the Dalai Lama?
Well, that was interesting. They kind of, at the time, they would, basically the way it worked was he came in and did kind of a group interview. And so there were certain writers, and that was a print campaign, actually. So we're working with publications like Time Magazine and the New York Times, and religion writers mostly, and they would sit down with him. I think, you know, that it was interesting in that it was a very limited, high profile kind of visit, but the book was great.
Yeah. So you mentioned that radio is your specialty, but it sounds like you do also do some print publicity.
We did. That was a while ago. We used to. I think now the people that handle that best are the publicists in-house for the publishers. They have those relationships, you know, especially with the book reviews, which are still so important. They're really good at that. I also question sort of the impact of kind of like what you would say off the book page kind of mentions, like if someone's doing an article, say, getting back to the sleep example, on sleep, and then interviews our sleep specialist. I don't think that's necessarily as effective as sort of an interview about his book. Mm. So those opportunities are a little more limited. I mean, that's definitely been a change over the years. In terms of, there used to be a lot more columnists, like lifestyle columnists, that would write about books that would really drive sales, and that the impact of those, you know, I think there's has lessened.
What about reader reviews on Amazon and Goodreads? And are there do they matter? How much, and how do authors encourage people to get to write those reviews?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think they matter a lot. You know, I think Goodreads is its own animal. I mean, I one thing that we do caution our authors about is, like, you know, don't just read those obsessively and look at your sales numbers on Amazon, because it'll make you crazy. Because they do. They get, you know, people take criticism really hard, especially... I think also they take it really hard when it's kind of careless criticism, when someone mm-hmm. just is kind of spouting off and really hasn't read the book carefully, and it's not a fair representation of their work. And that's where I see people really get upset, because they want to engage in that and they want to correct it, and you can't really. But we do, you know, encourage people to encourage their friends and family to put notes up, you know, about their book, and start the conversation for them, because we find that, you know, once some people start weighing in, more and more will, and that's generally a good thing. And you can see too, I mean, I look at them, I think you can see you can gauge the popularity of a book too by the number of reviews, right?
Yeah.
You know, some of these bigger books like Wonder or something like that, they'll just have a gazillion reviews, and it's amazing.
I know, when I get like the Kindle, Amazon Prime, you get a free digital book every month, and if I sometimes I download them, sometimes I don't, but when I look at them, and I'll look at the number of reviews, because if a book only has 18 reviews, I think, okay, it's probably self-published. It's
his relatives,
and it's probably his relatives,
right.
And I, because what you talked about before with why it's easier for you to work with publishers, why it's easier for me to work with publicists, is because somebody else is vetting the book and
right.
and saying, yes, this book is of a certain quality of writing.
Right.
Yeah. Because there's just so many out there. And you can't, like you said, you can't spend the time to read every single one. And you know, just like the old slush pile where they said, if you don't capture somebody in the first page, when people send me books, if on the first two pages I'm like, this writing isn't very good, I'm not going to keep going because of the amount of time that I have. And sometimes people are lucky to even get someone to look at the first two pages. If you don't have somebody representing you that has sort of vetted you before.
Right. Yeah, that's really true, I think. And, you know, we just sometimes get overwhelmed with the just general amount of what's coming at us. And also, I could never sort of, you know, going back to the cookbook that we were talking about before, I could never, you know, try a couple recipes. I mean, I know some people can look at a cookbook recipe and know if it's good, and I forget it. No idea. So that's another, you know, Chronicle has such high standards for their cookbooks and the illustrations and the photographs and the actual recipes and the way everything is put together is just really amazing. But we took on an interesting self-published cookbook not too long ago. But, you know, the author was well-credentialed and experienced and kind of what, you know, the kind of person we were talking about
right. Not
too long ago. And again, that's an interesting genre too, because that can be, you know, they're definitely like the cooking shows and the cooking radio shows, but that can be hard for some people to talk about. You know, I think particularly the male interviewers, sometimes they'll just say, oh, please, Emily, don't make me interview a cookbook author.
I love to read cookbooks more than cook from them.
Oh, yeah. They're a whole, that's a whole kind of literature, I think. And the stories that come with cookbooks.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The best ones are part memoir and part cookbook. And I even have books like that my grandmother owned. There was a very, Elizabeth David, I think was her name, was a cookbook author who wrote books like that probably back in the
40s. Oh, yeah. That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
I see books they're not books yet, but I see people having websites that do stories and cooking, you know, and then they put it together and make a book out of it. Do you find that books are like that? They're compilations of a blog, say, or cookbooks done like that?
Ah, just like Julie and Julia, where
right.
she started out with the blog and ended up with a publishing contract. Is there much of that? Are bloggers moving into books?
I mean, I think, like, wouldn't you categorize sort of Smitten Kitchen as a blog too? I think I think that's another example. You know, at first I think that was a real fresh kind of thing, the blogging, and then a lot of the bloggers were getting book deals. And then we were getting a little pushback from the media saying, all right, everybody has a blog now.
But there was some...
You know, they were like, if someone comes to me again saying their credentials are a blog.
Yeah,
so.
But there were some really good ones. There was, I think, No Baggage. I think that one came from a blog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, there's some really good ones, I think. But I think there were also, it just became kind of just overused. I mean, you know, publishers, they tend to do that. They'll sort of, you know, oh my gosh, memoirs popular. Let's, you know, publish a million memoirs until finally everyone's like, enough, and there's a glut, you know, and then they'll move on to the next thing.
So what's trending now in the publishing world?
One of the things that's really, really popular genre, and it can be tricky publicity-wise, are books about dogs. And that, they must sell like crazy because constantly, you know, whether it's a funny book or a more serious book, but people love dog books. It's So that's a, and at some point we kind of have to say, okay, we can't do another dog book.
So stories about people and their dogs.
We like dogs, but it just gets a little much. There are pet radio shows that, you know, they can hit up, but there aren't that many. So I always thought that was kind of funny. You know, Leslie and I would look at each other and shake our heads. Wow, another dog.
Well, were they mostly like dog memoirs? Or I know there were some that there was a couple about dogs' smell, their sense of smell, and sort of the history.
Yes, we worked on one of those, which is, you know, it's really interesting science.
Yeah.
Some of them are just about, you know, a memoir that has, it's heavily involves their dog, whether they're, you know, there was an accident or a death in the family and the dog was somehow helpful and, you know, that they just got a dog and how it changed their lives. Or there was one we worked on not too long ago that was all about, and it was really fun, interesting memoir, just all about, like, stories from the dog park. So it is a really funny, you'll notice when next time you go into bookstores now, you'll see there's like all these dog books.
Now, when you, does the publicity campaign tend to start at the, like right when the book is released or right before or right after? How, what's the timing work for that?
We generally start in about 2 to 4 weeks beforehand.
So build up
maybe a little longer, depending on the book. But I think in terms of the in-house efforts and, like, print efforts or potentially, you know, bigger things like, you know, big television shows and that kind of thing, that can start as much as 6 months to 8 months prior.
Prior to publication.
A lot of people go to Book Expo in New York. Have you ever?
I haven't. I have been to the Texas Book Festival.
Oh, great. Yeah. So, I mean, Book Expo is something that's kind of faded in terms of importance over the years as well, because there are less and less independent bookstores. That's generally what it was before. But I do think that, you know, it's a good time for publishers to announce sort of, you know, splashy new books, that kind of thing. So they do that and have a lot of book signings and for media and for booksellers around the country.
Now, there used to be a really big book fair in Europe that everybody went to. Is that still a thing?
Frankfurt?
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe so, and that's more for sort of international, right?
Okay.
And that's an interesting thing, you know, different books will sell in different countries, and to hear the authors talk about the publicity process and the different titles and the way that people talk about their books in various countries. A lot of the historical fiction, you know, if it takes place outside of the United States in particular, it will be picked up around the country. Mm. Germany picks up a lot of our books, and but it's really fun to hear their stories of it going to Australia or to promote, and just the kind of various differences and similarities in the promotion. It's fun.
Yeah, I noticed that the covers of books are different, too, in different countries. Even between the UK and America, even though they're both English, they may have a completely different cover.
Yeah, my first book with Amy, It's a Chick Thing. I loved our American jacket. It was kind of a retro picture of women, kind of from the 50s. And the one I still have, the foreign copy I still have, it cracks me up. It's it's from Russia, and the women are wearing almost like Jane Fonda-esque, like, aerobic outfits.
Oh! Not 50s.
It's really this is never a jacket that I could never see in America, but I love to look at it.
You know, I just listened to a radio show on, it was probably on NPR yesterday, that was talking about female friendship, so that must be another trending topic again.
Oh, great.
Yeah, maybe you need to re-release your book.
Yeah, that'd be fun. So it is a really fun that makes sense, too, given everything that's going on lately. The other thing that's resurging, too, is that a long time ago, I don't know if you remember, but we worked on this book called Random Acts of Kindness.
Mm. Oh, yes.
And that was a big movement back in the 90s, and it was just really sweet. It was just a sweet book with true stories of, you know, random acts of kindness, and you could not get through, you know, 5 or 6 pages without crying. It was just lovely in sentiment, and it became this huge sort of national movement, and there was a Random Acts of Kindness Day, which is still kind of around, and it seems to be kind of resurging again. We're working on a book this month, actually, called The Kindness Cure. And it comes from a little more of a scientific perspective, sort of talking about what it means to you personally and your body and what happens when you are kind, you know, and why we love to feel that way. But, it's interesting to see these trends kind of come back again.
Oh, well. Any other, like, dogs and anything else in the fiction world that's really trending now? So are we past vampires yet?
zombies were big.
Typically the National Book Award drives a lot of big fiction, but I don't think that was the case as much this year as it has been. So I haven't seen, you know, quite as much of a big blockbuster myself out there that's just really the book that everybody has to read and everybody wants to read kind of thing. Like, I even felt like, but, and the thing that's wonderful about that, too, is that, if a book like that is not going to eclipse other sales, it expands the market for books, because what happens is it's driving people into the bookstores.
Yes.
And they tend to go in, and then they'll find other books that they want to read. So it's a really great thing, and I'm not sure that I see anything right now that is sort of at that level. On a fiction
perspective. So no Harry Potters, no Twilight series.
We can always hope,
we
right?
Can always hope. But,
I don't know. Is there something that you think is just the book to read this year?
Oh, you know, I'd have to think about that. I don't think I've seen anything that's quite grabbed me that strongly either. But a lot of good books, books out there, and we cover a lot of them here. And unfortunately, we're out of time today.
Wow, okay.
I know. So, Emily.
Well, this is a lot of fun. It went by fast.
Emily Miles Terry, thank you so much for being with us today, learning a little bit more about book publicity. And I think, Crystal, you have some final words for us.
I have a quote from Mark Twain.
My favorite.
Writing is easy. All you have to do is cross out the wrong words.
Stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild.
That's great. Thank you. Nice to talk to you both.
See you next week on Writers' Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.
Jonathan from